Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable. Thank you, Alice, for all the care and the crafting and the heart that you put into that statement. Anyone who is tuning into this podcast, if you would like to read this statement again in detail or find out more about what we do, please go online to cearts.org. That's cearts.org to find out more about what we do. And I would love to hear, Alice, a little bit about, we know that who we are as individuals shape what we do, how we see the world. I would love to hear a little bit more about how that fits into the picture for you.
Okay. I would be happy to share that on the condition that you do the same when I'm done. Well, you know, I truly believe that how and where we grow up matters. It informs our perspective on people who look different than we do. In other words, you know, the words like race, biological sex, you know, they, you know, look different. It informs our perspective on people who worship differently than we do in terms of religion and ethnicities, and people who love differently than we do in terms of, you know, gender identity and sexual expressions and preferences and everything. So I feel like, you know, how we grow up, where we grow up, what our life experiences are, that all, it all, you know, molds together to have us become who we are. And the issue for me, I think, the big thing is that I've always felt that intolerance is the beginning. Intolerance for those who are different leads to prejudice, discrimination, and racism, all of which are cultural constructs. We aren't born with those things. We're taught them. I mean, we're born into a world where those exist. And again, depending on where we grew up and how we grew up and all that kind of stuff, how we feel about connecting to those cultural constructs can be very different place to place. What informs me personally, well, science matters, cultural constructs matter, the things, and I bring up science right away because having studied anthropology and having a master's degree in anthropology, I had to take physical anthropology classes, and I learned a lot more about science and physical, the human physical genes and what makes humans human than I ever did before I took those classes, certainly more than I ever learned in high school biology class or anything like that. So, you know, I feel like science is such an important part of the conversation. Things we see as different in each other, the visible characteristics that we could see in humanity, like things that are called racial, you know, racial characteristics, in other words, like skin color, hair texture, things like that. Those are just like blood types. They are phenotypic expressions of our common human genotype. The phenotypic expressions can be visible and invisible. Blood groups are invisible, but they are phenotypic expressions, just like skin color is. Skin color just happens to be visible. So we all have the same genes. And the genes are expressed in a spectrum of those phenotypic characteristics. Again, some visible, some invisible. The visible ones have come to be expressed, you know, in because of our ancestral, if you will, our ancestral environmental variables that determined survival of our species over thousands of years. This is the most basic example that you know I've ever heard is lighter skin in cold climates, darker skin in hotter climates. And that has everything to do with melanin and sweat production and cooling the body down. And, you know, depending on what environment you live in, your physical characteristics adapted to that environment. Ancestrally, you know, years ago. And so because I've studied a little bit about that, I'm by no means an expert or anything. I get that. I get that the things that people see and are intolerant about that are different in other groups of people, for lack of a better phrase, are really just a scientific expression of our common genes, our common humanity. And so to me, it would be as ridiculous to be prejudiced against certain blood types as it is to be prejudiced against certain skin color. I'm simplifying, and I'm not meaning to be offensive by simplifying, because I'm not discounting the huge impact that racial intolerance has in our country and around the world. But I wanted to sort of give you a little bit about how I see the construct of race as being a misunderstood, based on a fallacy, if you will. It's like the premise is flawed. We don't discriminate based on blood type because we can't see blood type. Okay, so we're choosing to discriminate against a group of people because of what we can see, when in fact, genetically speaking, we're all the same. We're human beings. That's our race. For most of my life, at least my adult life, I've felt pretty lonely as a liberal progressive Democrat in living in Indiana. I have a note to myself, a post-it note says, hopefully our city, county, and state's political demographics can change for the better soon. But, you know, that's always kind of weighed on me that somehow I ended up in Indiana when I don't really feel like a lot of the times in my lifetime here since the mid-70s that I've really fit in some ways. And I should probably make it clear that my family moved up here from Columbus, Georgia. My father was working for the Army as a research psychologist at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. And so I lived there for most of my childhood up until junior high. We didn't fit in there either. I mean, it was a very strange and surreal. Even as a child, I was very aware that people didn't think the way my family thought or the way I thought about people who looked different, you know, specifically in Georgia, you know, Black Americans. I was raised to not believe in racism and to believe in equality. And that was just not a popular attitude in Georgia. It was an unpopular attitude. I referenced it. I lived there, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And, the first Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education happened in 1954. The second Supreme Court decision in Brown, the one that said integration must occur, quote, with all deliberate speed, unquote, was handed down by the court in 1955. But I can tell you, in the Deep South, they didn't recognize the rule of law for years. Jimmy Carter was elected governor of Georgia in 1970, and blacks and whites were still segregated in neighborhoods and businesses, churches, and schools. My schools were segregated. We didn't have black children in my schools. Then in, I think it was from May to July in 71, Columbus, Georgia, the town I lived in, the city I lived in, erupted with civil rights protests. There were protests by black Americans against discrimination, especially against the police, and protests by whites against integration, especially school integration. Governor Carter had to declare a state of emergency. I mean, it was bad. It was a bad, violent time. And I remember the morning that buses from black neighborhoods brought the first black kids to my school. It was in 1971. It was elementary school, and it was a really ugly time to see white parents dragging their children out of the school because they didn't want them to be in classes with black kids. I'm happy to report that my parents did not do that. I was not raised to believe in racism, so that was the culture in Columbus, Georgia that I lived in and my family lived in. We moved up here to Noblesville, Indiana in the mid-70s, and by comparison, life in Noblesville from the mid-1970s until Donald Trump's presidential campaign in 2015 was more quietly racist. It wasn't, on the surface, the majority of Noblesville and Hamilton County residents were like a huge portion of the country. They were politically correct on the surface. But it didn't take long living here to realize that a lot of prejudice and discrimination and racism lay just beneath the surface of that political correctness. And sadly for the world, after the 2015 campaign and the 2016 presidential election, a lot of that surface political correctness has just disappeared. And all kinds of intolerance, prejudice, discrimination, and racism has surged to the forefront of white behavior, for lack of a better phrase. And in Hamilton County, like we said in our statement, there are pockets of white allies, there are pockets of Democrats and independents and good Republicans who aren't racist, and some of those pockets exist in Noblesville. So, this all sounds very negative, but I really don't mean it that way. I'm hopeful for the future. I just feel like we have to be honest about who we are and where we come from, and that, things that we perceive as racial, like skin color and hair texture, are truly just phenotypic expressions of our common human genotype. That said, the hardest thing to deal with is being a white person and trying to have these discussions honestly and not offend people. You don't want to offend people because, and I don't know how else to say this, I'm just going to say it, I believe that every white person is racist to some degree. We live on a racist spectrum, if you will, because our system, our culture, has such absolute systemic racism in it, and white privilege is part of that systemic problem. And so white people all live on this spectrum of racism. White supremacy and fascism, exists on one end of the spectrum, and anti-racism, white ally, is the other end of the spectrum. And I think that it's really hard for white people to admit they have white privilege, but the fact that they have white skin means that they have white privilege. That's just a fact. And I feel like we need to acknowledge that I'm sitting here, an almost 57-year-old white woman, and I'm sitting here, I'm going to talk about racial issues. That's white privilege. I have white privilege just sitting here with white skin. So hopefully that it can be seen as a conversation trying to, be constructive, not destructive. Some of the people who have white privilege hold on to it closely. They find it very dear, and they truly believe that they are somehow superior to or deserve more than people of color. And I think these are the white people that are publicly intolerant, prejudiced. They don't even acknowledge that systemic discrimination and racism exist, and they are racist in their words and actions. Then there are some white people who just simply don't understand or admit that they have white privilege, that white privilege is just having white skin means you have white privilege. They don't get that. Many of the people in that group mean well. They may mean well, and they think of themselves as not racist, but they are often unwittingly intolerant or prejudiced. They often don't acknowledge systemic discrimination in certain areas. And unfortunately, that means that they can come across as racist in both word and action. That's where, you know, we struggle as white people to be part of the conversation, is to, you know, walk that fine line of trying to be an advocate and an ally, but not go across any lines into being inappropriate or offensive or racist, you know. Being not racist is just not good enough anymore. I think today's issue for white people is a choice. You get to stay racist or you get to become an anti-racist white ally to people of color. And hopefully, you know, people who are interested in our organization are in the latter group, you know, and it's not an easy or comfortable thing to try to embrace being an anti-racist white ally for a lot of people, because it's such a different, uncomfortable way of looking at themselves and their place in the world. And it's you know, white people have almost like a collective consciousness and perception that's so deeply ingrained of belonging to the dominant group. And you know, we're raised on beliefs that stem from thousands of years of systemic racism and discrimination and white supremacy throughout the world. We're raised on it. It's you know, we are born into that world. That doesn't mean we have to be born into racism, though. But those beliefs are written in our history books. Our history books don't even tell the truth. And so we have this deeply ingrained issue that we need to confront about who we are and where our place in the world is alongside people of color and other minorities. And so becoming an ally, especially a white ally in issues that involve Black Americans and other people of color, it requires a complete shift of how we see ourselves and our place in the world. And again, I want to acknowledge that there is a very fine line between empathy and sympathy and appropriation. As a white ally, you know, we want to support and defend people of color. We don't want to take charge of their message. It's their message. It's, you know, it's their issue. We want to support them. And that's how I feel personally, and that's I wish I could find better words to say all of that, but That's basically where I'm coming from in my efforts to try to be an anti-racist white ally in this world. This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.